Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books Network. I am your host, Ari Barbalat. Today, I'm honored and blessed to be in dialogue with Dr. George A. Kiraz. He is a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton University. Today, we are going to be in dialogue about his new book, Water the Willow Tree, Memoirs of a Bethlehem Boyhood, published in Piscataway, New Jersey by Gorgias Press, 2022. George, it's an honor to be in dialogue with you today.
Thank you so much.
To begin, please tell us about yourself. Where did you grow up? What formative events in your life inspired the scholar you'd become as an adult?
I was born and raised in Bethlehem, in the West Bank in Palestine. What inspired the scholar in me? My parents always advocated for education. And at church, I was surrounded by clergy, both monks and priests and deacons, who valued reading and writing and education. And I think that's what kind of kindled it for me.
What inspired you to write this book? What message do you hope to convey to your readers?
So this book, basically my memoirs, many people, when they were hearing my stories, they always encouraged me to kind of write memoirs. But I've always found the experience a bit dull because you're sitting and writing about yourself. And to be honest with you, I tried a few times and it didn't work. You know, you would go a few pages and you would stop. But in 2020, the pandemic, gave the setting for it. We were all cooked up at home. And I thought, that's a good time to sit and do it. And what also encouraged me is that summer, my son had digitized my father's archive, my mom's notebooks, my own archive. So now I had kind of data to go with as well. So it became kind of memoirs / research project.
What are the primary themes in this book? What story does your memoir tell?
It tells the story of a boy raised up in Palestine, but a boy in a community that is kind of on the peripheries of the conflicts in Palestine, because I belong to a minority, to a Syriac minority. And while Syriac history in Palestine is quite ancient and old, but the current families in Palestine are basically survivors of the 1915 genocide, which took place in Ottoman Turkey. So the community basically was an immigrant community within Palestine and lived on, as I said, on the peripheries of the conflicts that were going on. I mean, at least that's how my life was.
What would you like listeners to get out of our dialogue today?
If they can get to not know me, but know my community through me, through my story, through the story of my family. If they can get to know the Syriac community, it's an ancient community dispersed all over the Middle East, now mostly in the diaspora. It's a community that has an existential problem because we are not that many people. So if they can get to know my community through me, I'll be very happy.
In what ways was the writing process that went into this book therapeutic for you? Can you elaborate?
It was therapeutic in the sense that my story is not a jolly story. You know, in a way, it's a sad story of an immigrant family who survived genocide and then in 1948 lost its properties again because of the Arab-Israeli war, and became refugees one more time for a second time. You know, that means financially our family was not strong after 1948, so we had to grow up with that. And that, you know, entails difficulties in life. So it gave me an opportunity, and also gave my sisters an opportunity to reflect upon that, because I had to discuss many things with them and to remind me with a few things that I didn't know about, or tell me a few things that I didn't know about. So from that perspective, it was therapeutic and useful.
What does your book teach us about trauma?
Well, it teaches us about the trauma of wars. My family story is a story of immigrants. They used to live in what is now Southeast Turkey, Upper Mesopotamia. And as a result of the 1895 massacres that took place, they had to move within the bounds of the Ottoman Empire. And again, the major move was in 1915. After the genocide, they had to leave their hometown and become an immigrant community in a bigger city in Adana. My father was 4 years old, or three maybe, when they had to leave Adana, and walking and on donkeys all the way down to Lebanon, and then later on down to Palestine. And my father then built himself and made a good life for himself in Jerusalem, only to lose everything in 1948 again. So it's a big issue with the trauma of war.
What is your book's contribution to the history of Syriac Christianity in the 20th century?
So basically, my story is the story of many other families. And one of my friends was reading it, and he said, I really enjoyed it because it also tells the story of my family, although they are in the different regions in the Middle East. It depicts this tiny community that lived in different towns and villages and areas of the Middle East, dispersed really in a large geographical area, under 500,000 people, but bound by an identity that connected them to their patriarch, to their church. And then they faced that trauma of genocide, and then they had to migrate within the Middle East to rebuild themselves. And although my story stops in 1983, when I left Bethlehem and immigrated to the United States, history keeps repeating itself with current wars in the Middle East, where now the Syriac community is uprooted again and is mostly in the diaspora.
How does your book advance our understanding of the Seyfo genocide?
It depicts the genocide quite vividly. Talks about my father's side of the family. My mother's side of the family had my grandfather from my mom's side had gone to Bethlehem when he was 13 before the Seyfo genocide. So they were not affected. They heard of Seyfo and didn't go back. So that was the effect on them. But on my dad's side, I show the movement throughout the Ottoman Empire due to the Seyfo genocide, but also from his mom's side. His mom's side, so that's my grandma, was an Armenian. So also it depicts how they also had to move, and both the Syriac and the Armenian families met in Adana, and that's how my grandpa met my grandma and they got married. It's a vivid story of Seyfo.
What does your book teach us about listening?
Listening. Listening to others or?
Yeah, the importance of listening, the value of listening, the significance of listening. What role does listening play in the narrative in your book?
Well, there is listening in the sense of you listen to your parents and you be a good boy basically and be a good girl. I was not an easy child, but I did listen to advice and also to the advice of my teachers, both in the boarding school that I attended, and as well as the monks and the priests of the church. But also there is the sense of attentively listening through, not hearing, but listening through reading. So, hopefully people who read the book, they will perceive my story through imagining the voices of genocide and war and trauma, but also of this little boy who is growing up in a little town of Bethlehem, which is kind of a Christian enclave in the Middle East, amongst other communities, and how that affected his life.
What new insights does your book reveal about the Armenian genocide?
So the story of the Syriacs and the Armenians is similar. Percentage-wise, a lot of Syriacs were killed and displaced. The absolute number of Armenians is much higher because you're talking about a much bigger community. But the story is very, very similar. Admittedly, the Ottoman Empire most likely went after the Armenians rather than the Syriacs or other Christian communities. But on the ground, the people who were executing the genocide made no distinction. And that's how the Syriacs and other communities also became victims of this genocide.
What was the biggest adversity you faced growing up? How did you cope? How were you impacted later in life by such difficulty?
So the difficulties that I will be talking about were not difficulties at the time, because that was the norm of life, living under occupation, for example. Living in a family that didn't have much financial means, it was still a good life. And although now retrospectively we look at it and we say, that must have been a difficult life, but when that is the norm and that's how you're growing up, you don't see it that way. Of course, going back now and visiting after many years, I see that the occupation portion of the story is much worse now. So the way we had it, well, we were in a much better shape in the 1970s and 1980s. We managed.
What does your book reveal about Syriac Christians' experiences of the 1948 war?
So the Syriacs of Palestine, as I said, arrived there as immigrants because of the genocide. And some lived in Jerusalem. About half of them lived in Jerusalem, and the other half in Bethlehem. And maybe even the Jerusalem community was a bit bigger at the time, before 1948. But then when 1948 came, a lot became refugees. They lost their homes, and that was the case of my father. My father had built a very nice villa house in Telepiot, which was an, you know, upcoming and affluent neighborhood of Jerusalem on the road to Bethlehem. So he lost that and became a refugee. And then many other people became refugees. And if you look at the record of the families in Bethlehem, there's a list before 1948, a list after 48, and you see how after 1948, the Bethlehem community became much larger. And then after 1967, even when Israel took hold of the old city, more and more people had to leave what is now called the Jewish Quarter, that is adjacent to the Syria Quarter. So the border with the Syriac Quarter had a lot of Syriac families living in what is now the Jewish Quarter. But a bit by bit, families were asked to leave. We have anecdotes and stories, and this applied not only to Syriacs, but to the others, where after 1967, the Israelis will offer some financial compensation for people to leave, and some would leave and some would stay. But in the case of the Syriac family, many wanted to stay, and they said, no, we want to stay. The offer was, why don't you go to Amman and, you know, build something, and here is some gift, let's say. And many families wanted to stay. But then at some point, the authorities went to the leadership of in the monastery, and they said, you know, you need to advise your people. Either they're going to have to leave and get some sort of a compensation, or if they refuse, they're just going to have to leave without anything. We will basically kick them out of their homes. So in after 1967, you start seeing another wave of people leaving Jerusalem because they had to leave Jerusalem.
How did Syriac Christians experience the 1967 war? How were the consequences similar or different in 1967 vis-a-vis 1948? What does your book reveal? In particular, perhaps can you comment on the Syriac quarter of the old city and the consequences of the 1967 for the Syriac quarter within the old city?
Yeah, so as I just mentioned, after 1948, many people remained within the Syriac quarter. But after 1967, as Israel took hold of the old city, they forced the majority of the families to leave. The result now is that you have no more than 70 families in the old city. The Syriac quarter remains sandwiched between the Armenian quarter and the Jewish quarter now. And I remember in the 70s when a new building settlement was built right across from the Syriac monastery of St. Mark's. And until now, you know, it remains there. In Bethlehem, I tell the story of the 1967 war and how my father was, you know, visiting his parents, and then he had to avoid shells in order to go back home and to protect us. But the war was not that long. It settled pretty fast. And there is a letter that my father was writing to John C. Trevor in the U.S., which he started before 1960, before the war. And it used to take him a few days to write his letters. And then you see a line in the letter and says, you know, until now I was writing under Jordanian sovereignty. Now I am writing under Israeli occupation. And then he's asking Trevor to contact his sisters and in Amman, in Kuwait, in Lebanon, just to tell them that he is okay. So that's how it affected the communities.
What is your book's contribution to Bethlehem's modern history and historiography?
So Bethlehem, when I grew up, was a Christian majority, and the Syriac community was a vibrant portion of that. And as I said, the Syriac community was an immigrant community. Bethlehemites are configured around clans. These are like the primary clans of the town of Bethlehem. The Syriacs are outside of that configuration because they do not belong to these clans. So the book basically depicts how a small minority is living within a Christian town and the dynamics between the communities.
What does your book teach us about love? What role does love play in your memoir? How is love characterized?
I have tried to the best of my ability to depict basically the life as I experienced it. And I tried also to the best of my abilities to describe this life, which is within conflicts, not only conflicts because of the Arabs and the Israelis and their conflict with each other, but also, you know, conflicts as the Syriacs being a minority amongst the Bethlehemites, conflicts with the other Christian communities in the holy places, primarily with the Armenian community. I tried to depict these things as much as possible with grace, that is what you take out of it, is that communities need to coexist.
How has the city of Bethlehem changed in the course of your lifetime? How is Bethlehem's social geography different today than you remember it as a child?
So during the time when I grew up, 70s and 80s, the changes, if anything, were gradual. So there wasn't that much that was noticeable. What was noticeable were two things. One was on the peripheries of the towns near Bethlehem. Settlements were being built by the Israeli government. I do remember seeing trucks transporting basically complete walls of homes. So people in the Middle East used to build homes stone by stone. These were not stone by stone homes. These were wall by wall, basically, homes. You would find, you would see a big truck basically carrying four walls, which is making an entire room, probably. And that was the settlement of Gilo near Beit Jala. So I witnessed that growing around the city of Bethlehem. Another thing that became noticeable was after the Iranian Revolution, when Khomeini came to power, we began to see smaller Muslim community of Bethlehem changing a bit, where you would start seeing schoolgirls beginning to wear the hijab day by day, it became more and more. And that the word on the street was that that was because of Iranian influence and Iranian support to try to change the face of Islam itself within the city of Bethlehem. So that's what I myself witnessed. I did not visit Bethlehem after I lived for 30 years. And these two issues, after I went after 30 years, of course, because you don't see them gradually changing, you see it exponential, of course. Now Bethlehem is surrounded by settlements all over the place, not to mention the wall that is surrounding Bethlehem. People cannot go in and out. This is particularly difficult for the Syrian community because they need to go to Jerusalem in order to participate in the liturgies of the holy places vis-a-vis the status quo. And they're not able to do that. So that is a bit problematic. And of course, the demography of the community of Bethlehem or the communities, plural, of Bethlehem seems to have drastically changed as well when you don't see it for 30 years and then you just come and see it. And of course, because I was a kid, everything looks big to you when you're a kid, apparently. I went to Bethlehem and everything looked smaller to me. But that's natural after you grow up.
What does your book reveal about the relationship between the Syriac Orthodox Church in Bethlehem and other Christian churches, such as the Armenian Orthodox Church, the Greek Orthodox Church, the Catholic Church, and other such churches?
So you have basically the different Christian traditions that you mentioned. And we experience it vividly every Christmas because Bethlehem, being the birthplace of Christ, it is the city of Christmas, celebrates Christmas three times every year. On December 25th is the Catholic Christmas or the Latin Christmas. And that's basically 25 of December, according to the Gregorian calendar, the calendar we use every day. The Eastern Christians also celebrate Christmas on the 25th of December, but according to the Julian calendar. So the equivalence of that is the 7th of January in our calendar. So on the 7th of January, there is a second set of celebrations. The Syriacs, the Copts, the Greeks, and the Ethiopians, they celebrate Christmas on that day. The Armenians, while Orthodox, have an ancient tradition of celebrating Christmas and Epiphany on the same day, on the 7th of January, but not on the same day as our Christmas, because also they follow the Julian calendar. So you have to add 13 days to that. It ends up being later in January, and that's where they celebrate Christmas and Epiphany at the same time. So you have 25th of December for the Catholics, then 7th of January for the Orthodox, apart from the Armenians, and then later on in the month for the Armenians. The relationship between these communities is very cordial, and they coexist quite well. The only issue is amongst the clergy, not really the people. Amongst the clergy, when it becomes about the issues of the status quo in the holy places, the Church of Resurrection in Jerusalem, Church of the Nativity, other places, there are regulations that dictate when and where each community can pray, what time, and sometimes things get too close for comfort, and sometimes conflict arise. But that's the life of the status quo, basically. That's what it is.
What does your book teach us about internal displacement?
So there are two internal displacements that took place. Of course, internal when you know depends on what you dictate is the geographical boundary of the place. During the genocide, there was a lot of displacement within Southeast Turkey, people going from town to town, city to city, trying to escape a genocide as things progressed. So that was kind of one displacement that is depicted in the book when I talk about family history. The second displacement localized basically was as the result of the 1967 war, when you had people from Jerusalem being displaced and becoming refugees in Bethlehem, like my family.
What does your book teach us about contemporary Palestinian history and heritage?
So the contemporary Palestinian story is a complicated story. And my book really gives an outsider's, initially at least, an outsider's view to the conflict. Because remember, my family arrived in the 1920s. In Jerusalem. And that is the period of time where you start seeing immigration by Jewish communities from Europe to the Middle East. And then, of course, more and more in the 30s. And I do say in the book that you're looking at a family that probably didn't even know Arabic initially. They came from Turkey. They spoke Turkish and Armenian. So you're talking about an outside, somebody looking at this conflict from the outside, a family, a poor family that is trying to survive within a conflict that is boiling and growing around it, and how to navigate, basically, your life through this conflict.
Two of the Syriac patriarchs of the Syriac Orthodox Church are referred to in your book, the Syriac patriarch Elias III and the Syriac patriarch Jacob III. Can you comment on their legacies? What was your relationship with Jacob III? What are your recollections of Elias III?
So Elias III was before my life. He was in the 20s and the 30s in the area. Basically, after genocide, the patriarch was told to leave Turkey, the modern state of Turkey. This is after Ataturk took hold of the new republic. The patriarch was more or less exiled out of Turkey. And now the patriarchate had no home because the home was in Mardin, which it was within the bounds of the modern Republic of Turkey. And that's why Elias III went to Jerusalem. The hope of the church was that maybe Jerusalem can become the new patriarchate. And they established a printing press in Jerusalem. They started sending the brains of the community to Jerusalem, the active monks, the intellectuals to Jerusalem. They planned to organize a synod that not only had bishops, but also other lower clergy and people not from the clergy. And the plan was to hold the synod in Jerusalem. But later it was postponed. And when the church was unable to basically create its patriarchate in Jerusalem, especially because of the status quo, the other communities, Christian communities, basically said that there is no precedence of the Syriacs having a patriarch in Jerusalem. So then they began to think of Mosul as a possible place for the patriarchate. And then they held that synod I talked about that was supposed to be held in Jerusalem. They held it in Mosul in Iraq. And then after Patriarch Elias went, he also went to India for a visit, and he died there. He didn't come back. As for Jacob III, he was the patriarch during my childhood, but he was in Damascus. He visited in the 1960s Bethlehem and Jerusalem, but either I was not born or I was a few years old, so I have no recollection. But I don't have personal contacts with him, or did not have, because he was based in Damascus. And you've got to remember, like today we have internet and WhatsApp, and we communicate with everybody everywhere. But as a Syriac community in Palestine, we were basically secluded from the rest of the Syriac community in the world, because we could not communicate with anybody within in the Arab world. Even if our bishops wanted to talk to the patriarch, he couldn't call him. There are no direct lines, phone lines. He had to write a letter and send it to somebody in Europe, and that somebody in Europe would send the letter to Damascus, and that's how they had to communicate.
A number of other officials of the Syriac Church are presented in your book. Bruder Jacob, Bruder Victor, Bruder Siegfried, Bruder Jacobus, Bruder Daniel, and Bruder Matthias. Can you tell us about some of these figures? What were your relationships like with them? How are they presented in your memoir?
So these figures are part of the Lutheran Church, and I grew up in a boarding school, in a Lutheran boarding school. So at home, I had access to the Syriac tradition, but at school, we were raised with a Lutheran tradition. And those brothers, Bruder means brother in German, and the Lutherans or the institutions were German institutions in Palestine. So the brothers used to do camps for us, Bible study, take us on trips, and I became close with them. And I do describe in the book how that gave me access to the European style of life. And from a religious perspective, it gave me access to a tradition, the Lutheran tradition, which is very different from my Syriac tradition. And I basically had the best of both worlds. It broadened my horizon, and I think this is why, it made me a person who likes intercultural things.
Your book says some very interesting things about the history of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Can you elaborate on your relationship with some of the individuals involved in early scholarship on the Dead Sea Scrolls? What is your personal relationship to the Dead Sea Scrolls manuscripts? How does your memoir contribute to the history of the discovery of the scrolls and the controversies surrounding the various claims to them?
My father, as I said, built this villa house in Tel Apiot. And after finishing the house, basically they were trying to make a garden in the backyard, and it's a hill. So they wanted to flatten the hill. So they went to the top of the hill and started drilling a rod, basically, so that they can make a big hole and basically dynamite the hill so they can flatten it. And all of a sudden, that rod that they were trying to drill into the ground fell into the ground. Then my father realized that there's a cave there. So he had the workers open, go down, and then open it from the bottom. And then they discovered caves with ossuaries. And then my father reported that to the Department of Antiquity, and they sent an Israeli or Jewish at the time, Jewish archaeologist. The State of Israel was not born yet. Jewish archaeologist named Eleazar Sukenik. So my father came to know Sukenik. A year or two later, a couple of years later, the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, and they ended up in the Syriac, or portions of them, in the Syriac monastery in Jerusalem with the bishop. My father was a very close friend with the bishop. And then the bishop was looking for somebody to help him financially. According to my father and the bishop became partners to the scrolls. My father provided the financial assistance that the bishop needed, and that's how they became 50-50 partners. And one day, my father contacted this archaeologist, Eleazar Sukenik, and said, can I meet you? And then he basically came to the meeting holding in his hands the Dead Sea Scrolls to get the opinion of Sukenik. And then the scrolls were in my father's house for some time. Then they were taken for a second scholarly opinion by the Americans at the American School of Oriental Research in Jerusalem. So that is my father's involvement with the scrolls. He became a partner, according to him, with the bishop. But then later on, the bishop denied this partnership and took the scrolls without my father's knowledge to the United States, where he sold them. So that is the first involvement of my father with the scrolls. The second one was when research began by scholars about the history of the scrolls in the 1950s and the 1960s. They came to know of my father's involvement, and scholars became to write to him from the United States. And basically, the archive that my father have with this communication is very rich about the history of the scrolls, because one particular scholar, John C. Trevor, would every time send questions to my father, and my father would go meet with the Bedouins who discovered the scrolls, or different personalities that played a role in the scroll, and would get answers to these questions, write them back to John C. Trevor. So it's an archive of the research, basically. That is my father's archive, or portion of it, which I mentioned my son Kenoro digitized, and helped, and that's what helped me write the memoirs.
Who is Abuna Yaqub? What does your book reveal about him?
So Abuna Yaqub was the priest of Bethlehem, the Syriac priest. During my childhood, he is the one who taught me the Syriac language. He is the one who taught me how to read liturgies in the church. He was my first teacher, basically. And he always took care of me. He is the one who told my dad to bring me to the altar. And then I became a deacon, and I'm a deacon until now. He was my introduction to the Syriac church.
Can you tell us about Dairoyo Elio? What is notable about him?
Dairoyo Elio, who now lives in Holland at St. Ephraim's Monastery, Dairoyo Elio came to Jerusalem to become one of the monks of St. Mark's with his sister Seide. She was also a nun. In the late 1970s. And Dairoyo Elio was a scribe. And the tradition of scribes persisted until the advent of computer fonts in the late 1900s. So being a scribe was important. And when I was probably 13 or 14, I wanted to learn this art. So Dairoyo Elio taught me how to write with ink and with a reed. And he taught me how to fold papers, each five papers together, to make a quire or a signature. And then later on, he taught me, and he built for me a device to bind books. And he helped me how to bind books. And I'm grateful to him.
Who is Miss Munira Nasrallah? Can you say more about her?
Munira Nasrallah was a teacher at Talita Kumi, the school where I went. And she was a teacher of the Arabic language. We had a good bond together. During high school, my high school days, I wrote my my history of the Syria community in the Holy Land in Arabic. Of course, I was a teenager, so when I say I wrote a historical book as a teenager, most likely it's closer to collecting data from different material and made it into a cohesive book. I asked Munira or Miss Munira if she can edit the book for me. Arabic is not an easy language to write in. She was gracious and she agreed. She lived in a house on a hill that was not accessible by a street near the school, and it was a big hike to get to her house, and I used to go there. We used to sit all day long, read the text together, and she would be fixing the Arabic for the text.
Who is Patriarch Mutafian? Why is he a person of prominence? Can you say more about him?
Patriarch Mutafian, I met him much later in life. After I left, he was the Armenian Patriarch of Constantinople in Istanbul. And he visited the Syriac community in New Jersey. I talk about him in my epilogue, where I talk about how some of the existing problems can be fixed, and that was the current issues with the status quo between the Syriacs and the Armenians. And I commended how the Armenian Patriarch of Istanbul acknowledged the difficult relationship that was between the Syriac Church and the Armenian Church at the end of the Ottoman days. The Ottomans did not recognize the Syriac as an independent community, and they had to get access to the Sultan via the Armenian Patriarch of Constantinople and pay taxes through that patriarch. The same way the Greek Patriarch of Constantinople was responsible for all the Byzantine Orthodox communities, and they had to pay taxes through them. That was the Ottoman system. Instead of dealing with every community, they chose the Greek Patriarch to represent all Byzantines, even in the Orthodox in Eastern Europe. And they chose and installed an Armenian Patriarch in Istanbul to manage all the Oriental Orthodox, the Greeks, the Copts, within the Ottoman Empire in terms of taxes and in terms of representation with the state. With any power always comes a bit of abuse. It was difficult for these other communities that had no direct relation or direct representation with the Sultan to get their work done. They always had to go either through the Greeks, that's the Byzantines, or the Syriacs had to go through the Armenians, to the degree that in the late 1900s, we start seeing petitions arriving in Istanbul at the to the Sultan, both by the East European Byzantines, asking to no longer be under the Greek Patriarch, that they wanted direct representation. The same thing with the Syriacs, writing to Istanbul, saying we no longer want to be represented under the Armenian Patriarchate of Istanbul. We want to be represented independently and to deal with the Sultan independently. These things did not happen, but this difficult history between the Armenians and the Syriacs was acknowledged in the speech of the Armenian Patriarch, and that's why I mention him in the book.
Can you tell us about Butrus al-Tawil? What was his role in his life? How do you portray him in this memoir?
He was, again, somebody I did not meet, but I heard an anecdote about him. It's a funny anecdote because they used to say that my maternal grandfather used to predict things. For example, he used to predict that Hitler is going to fall. And also he predicted that Amman, the capital state of Jordan, is one day going to be ruined. And the anecdote is about these predictions. It is said that this man, Butrus al-Tawil, was a fan of the might that Hitler was projecting. And later on, this man immigrated after 1967. We said many Syriacs had to leave. He had to leave and settle in Amman. And the funny part of the anecdote is that during Black September, this is when there were problems amongst the Palestinians and the Jordanians in Jordan, fighting took place. This Mr. Tawil took his kids and left Amman. And people were saying, why did you leave Amman? I mean, this is a small conflict in a small portion of the city. Why are you leaving? Then he said, Abdul Ahad is my grandfather. He said, Abdul Ahad predicted that Amman is going to get ruined, so I am leaving. So that he is mentioned in that context.
Who is Barsoum Kiraz? Can you tell us about your relationship with him?
So Barsoum Kiraz was my father's uncle. As I said, my family, they left the Ottoman areas after the genocide. But before the genocide, Barsoum went to the United States, and he lived first in Western Massachusetts and then in the Hoboken area in New Jersey. My father lost touch with him. And my father had a picture of Barsoum on his desk in Bethlehem all the time. We grew up with this picture, and he always wanted to know his uncle, whom he never met. And after we immigrated to the United States, my father tried hard to find my uncle, even if he died, something about him. They went to the old address where he lived in Hoboken, New Jersey, or Weehawken. But of course, nobody could tell them anything. Unknown to my father, Barsoum had left to San Diego and died and was buried in San Diego. And we immigrated to Los Angeles. So it's really a pity we didn't, everything I'm telling you, we didn't know the story about Barsoum, that he went to San Diego. He is buried in San Diego, and my father lived in Los Angeles. At least we could have taken him to see the grave of his uncle, had we known at the time. But I discovered all of this after my dad passed away.
What does your book reveal about the history and historiography of Jerusalem? What is your book's contribution to Jerusalem studies or the study of Jerusalem?
It portrays really the life of individuals and families. It can be looked at as a social history of the people. It's not a history of states. It's not a history of conflicts. It's not a history of who controlled what when on the political arena, but it depicts the life of simple, ordinary people.
As we bring our dialogue today to a close, can you tell us about how you've been spending your time since you completed this project?
I moved to other projects, but I stayed within this project. I wrote an Arabic version of the memoirs, which I hope will be published this year. It's complete and has been copy edited. And now I am in the process of writing an abridged Syriac version of the memoirs.
I wish you the very best in your continued work. It has been an absolute privilege and honor to be in dialogue with you today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
To our listeners, I'm your host on the New Books Network, Ari Barbalat. Today, I've been in dialogue with George Anton Kiraz. He is a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton University. We've been discussing his new book, Water the Willow Tree, Memoirs of a Bethlehem Boyhood, published in Piscataway, New Jersey by Gorgias Press, 2022. Thank you.